Are vegans actually unhealthy?
Does cannabis ruin your sleep?
And why are so many men taking testosterone supplements? I'm Mitch.
And I'm Greg.
And we're the creators of the popular YouTube channel ASAP Science.
Every week on our podcast Side Note by ASAP Science, we explain the science behind a controversial subject with recent research, up-to-date studies, and ridiculous stories so you are entertained while, bam, simultaneously learning.
We're here to make science make sense.
Download Side Note by ASAP Science wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Story is brought to you by Scotia iTrade. There's a trader in all of us. Either Takesha McKitty died in September of 2017 at the age of 27 when she was declared brain dead after a drug overdose, or she died 3 days ago, 15 months later, aged 28, when her heart stopped beating.
The concept of the brain death, that's a concept, that's a theory, that's a diagnosis, but when the heart stops, then you know it's final. There's no questioning in that.
The legal fight around her diagnosis touched on everything that chills us about the ends of our lives and what happens to us then. But it also forced us to confront the terrible chasm between modern medicine and religion, and the arguments eventually made their way up to Ontario's highest court.
Courts heard the matter. They have all the materials and the evidence. They're in a position to rule on the matter, and I don't see any reason why they wouldn't rule on the matter.
What happens when doctors declare you dead, but you're still moving? What happens when you demand that your faith dictates your loved one receive valuable medical resources, even though science shows she's beyond help? Takesha died before the courts could rule on that, but she won't be the last person that lingers between life and death, with family members praying for a miracle that doctors know is impossible. And yes, it is easy to side with science when your head is clear and you're listening to a news podcast. But you can only imagine how quickly your mind might change depending on whose heart was still beating on the bed in front of you. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings, and this is The Big Story. Christina Howrun is a City News reporter who has been on this story since the beginning. So Christina, first of all, who is Takesha McKitty?
So Takesha McKitty is a Brampton woman who was declared brain dead back in September of 2017, and who actually only passed away completely on December 31st of 2018. Between 12 and 2, they realized that her lungs had finally given out and her heart had finally stopped beating.
So how did she end up brain dead, first of all? How did she end up in the hospital?
So in September of 2017, she suffered from a drug overdose. She was brought to Brampton Civic Hospital, part of the William Osler Health Systems Group. And she was in the hospital for 3 days. She never regained consciousness. And on September 20th, doctors declared her to be neurologically deceased, which essentially is brain dead.
Right.
And that has typically, or at least for the past decade or so, been used as a definition of death in Ontario.
So what happens once that declaration is made, usually?
Usually, a death certificate will be issued. Situations like this, the doctors of the hospital may give family members, you know, a couple of hours or maybe even a day to kind of bring in family that may be far away to say their farewells. And then typically, machines are unplugged and the person is laid to rest. In this case, the family refused to believe the doctor's diagnosis. They actually sought a court injunction to prevent the plugs from being pulled, and they were successful in that. They ended up in a very lengthy legal battle that really went all the way to the Ontario's highest court, the Ontario Court of Appeal, and those arguments were just heard earlier in December of 2018, but she was plugged in ICU for 467 days during this entire ordeal.
Did you see her?
I did. The family reached out to us to cover the story, and it's a very interesting story because it really is all about the dynamics of life and death.
Yeah.
But after I'd been working with the family and telling their story and talking to legal experts, I asked if I could, if they could sneak me in, so to speak, into the ICU. So the family did sneak me in, and I got to spend an hour or so with Takesha McKitty.
What is that like, and what kind of scene is it? I mean, she's brain dead. She's not moving. She's not communicating, obviously.
Well, that was the really interesting thing with this story as well, is that a lot of scientific studies say that, you know, typically after you've been declared brain dead, you'll stop moving between, you know, 48 and 72 hours. But really, it's because most people never remain plugged in.
Right.
For weeks and weeks and months and years on end. So when I went to go see Takesha McKitty, she had already been legally brain dead for several months, but she was moving. She would move her father's touch on her hand. If her father brushed on her leg, she may twitch and move. And science really doesn't still have a proper, fulsome explanation for how this could continue, you know, for 467 days. I know her family said she was still moving at the beginning of December. So she was moving throughout this entire time.
What did her parents say? How did they deal with that? And what's the basis for the legal argument they made for the injection?
Well, they had several legal arguments, but at the end of the day, their argument is that her freedom of religion wasn't being respected because they say that her belief was that life ends only when a heart stops beating and that she had communicated this with her family. Ultimately, a Brampton court decided that that wasn't a valid argument because the judge ruled that she doesn't have those constitutional rights because she is not legally alive. The Ontario's Court of Appeal just heard arguments now, and it's unclear if they're going to render a decision because Takesha McKitty has passed on. But they fully believed that she was still alive. And if, you know, I spoke with her father a couple of days ago, and he said, you know, he could always feel her soul in the room. And when he went in on December 31st, it wasn't there.
Up next.
It becomes a difficult spot to be in, medically speaking, as a staffer that may be dealing with the individual and treating the patient and thinking, how much time should I devote to her while there's this gentleman over here who isn't dead?
We all have investment goals, and Scotia iTrade can help you reach yours. Access free tools and resources to sharpen your investment skills. Visit ScotiaiTrade.com to start direct investing today. Scotia iTrade, there's a trader in all of us.
When you talk to doctors who obviously deal with the hard science of this, but also have to tell parents like hers when their child is gone, how do they grapple with that? The idea that you are legally dead, but of course your heart's still beating and sometimes you're even moving. Like, where did they come down on this?
Every Canadian physician that I've spoken to at different hospitals that were in the courtroom said, no, she is deceased. And they've said that from the get-go. The family did retain a physician from the U.S. who came in and said, no, the fact that she's still moving shows some level of brainstem functionality, that there was a presence there. And because she was, you know, she continued to, her hair still growed, her nails still grew.
Right.
She got sick and then she got better, right?
Oh, so man. So there's all the pretenses of being alive with none of the brain activity.
Yes, that was exactly it. That she never regained consciousness. She never spoke. She never made noises. But she certainly, she got sick. She got better. She had high blood pressure. They were able to lower it. So the physiological signs of life were very there. And I think it would have been very confusing for the family. Because they'd go in there and sometimes they'd talk to her and touch her and she wouldn't move, but then other times they would. She would.
Right.
So it's, and they were there 24/7. I mean, this is a family that really, they had somebody there 24 hours, 7 days a week. Just somebody was there doing shifts in the ICU room for 15 months.
And there was never a chance scientifically that she was going to wake up.
That's what the physicians say. The family still held out hope that she would.
So where does the use of medical resources come into this? Because you mentioned at the beginning of our talk that typically, you know, when a couple of hours or a couple of days to say goodbye, an ICU unit is not cheap.
No, it isn't. And that was something that was brought up by the Brampton judge, was that this could be a misuse eventually of resources. And you have to think about the impact that this has on the medical system, not just in this case, but if this was the way to go for anybody and everybody. The family and their lawyers obviously refute that. But at the end of the day, the hospital would never say how much it cost. And I think it's very difficult for them to really calculate that. But looking through the Canadian Institute of Health Information, they have average costs for an ICU bed. And so we calculated it based on the average cost of a medium-sized hospital ICU. And it's about $1.5 million.
For 15 months.
For 15 months. And that's not including the extra security or any other outside treatments that she would have had to receive.
Do we have any idea how often this happens?
It doesn't happen often. That's why this case is so...
Is there precedent here?
This would be the precedent leading case, setting case, at least in Canada. There, in fact, worldwide, nobody can, every expert that I've spoken with, bioethicists that have actually been keen to dig into this story, they've looked it up, and there are very few cases of people that have gone on like this. We've actually had professors reaching out because out of the States, because nobody really has gone 15 months. There's a couple of one-off cases out in New Jersey and California. But in Ontario, no, and probably not in Canada. Nobody can think of any.
When you had those ethicists reaching out to you, what kinds of questions come up most? Because obviously this is a life or death decision. Who has the right to make that decision?
Well, and that's why they wanted to weigh in on this, because it's ultimately, it's a very difficult situation to be in. Typically, families and substitute decision makers make these decisions, but when you are legally dead, it's tough for a hospital to continue throwing resources at you. And I don't want to say throwing resources, but it was one of the arguments that even the hospital's lawyer made, was that, you know, nurses are struggling with trying to care for her because they know that she has passed on, I guess, in the medically accepted and legally accepted sense of the word.
Right. And you don't want to be cruel about it at all, but there's no shortage. We're in the middle of an opioid crisis. There are no shortage of overdose cases that need ICU beds.
Right. Or people that are suffering from heart attacks or any other ailment. So I know that the family said that the nurses were fantastic, but it is a drain, right? It becomes a difficult spot to be in, medically speaking, as a staffer that may be dealing with the individual and treating the patient and thinking, how much time should I devote to her while there's this gentleman over here who isn't dead? I could see how that would be... draining on staff and draining on resources.
Yeah. How did you navigate this story as a reporter? Because again, you sort of have the facts, but you also have a family that's going through the worst thing a family can possibly go through.
I would say that in this case, perhaps more than ever, I really had to just say, this is what the family is saying. This is what the lawyers are saying. I was very aware that I could not allow my personal beliefs to interfere in this story. And I really tried to just treat it with kid gloves, because this is a family that really was going through.
Yeah.
Most people mourn and you go through a death and it's something that you may have to see and witness for a couple of days or weeks. But this is a family that had to deal with this every single day for 467 days. You know, Takesha McKitty is a mother. She has a 8 or 9 year old daughter who... She had that uncertainty. Her mom is dead, isn't dead, is coming back, isn't.
Some people say that she is. You can hear her heartbeat.
Yes, you could hear her heartbeat. You can hear her heartbeat. She would move. Her hair grows. I mean.
What is the end solution to these problems? Because they are going to, as we move on into the sort of uncharted territory of assisted death rulings and regulation in terms of what constitutes life versus death. Where do you think we end up? Like, do we need some sort of decision that everybody makes well in advance with, like, say, organ donation or that kind of stuff where you have your wishes already written down?
I think we do. But I mean, what do you do with a child? What do you do with somebody that is 20 years old? And, you know, when do you have to have that conversation? So I think that that's difficult, and that's a whole different issue.
Yeah.
When you have the conversation about what you want to happen to you, most people don't start having those conversations until they are faced with a disease or until they are faced with old age. But it is something that has to happen earlier, and it's something that, you know, this family, though, in this case, says did happen. I think that what's important is that it would be very helpful to other families that are in this situation or that will be in this situation if the Ontario Court of Appeals does issue a decision, because they decide, this isn't the first time. There's another case with a gentleman named Shalom Onunu who suffered from, I believe it was an asthma attack, and he ended up becoming brain dead. Now, he was a very devout Orthodox Jewish man, and his family fought saying he's not dead until his heart stops beating. They were in court. The arguments were heard. They were in the process of going through the court process when he passed on, and the judges there decided that this is a moot point because he's passed and the Takesha McKitty case is going on.
Right.
So,
And Takesha also passed before the decision came down.
She did. But Takesha's case is a bit different because all of the arguments had been heard.
Okay.
So the next step was only the decision. So it would be helpful if the Ontario Court of Appeals actually issued a decision, because it could change the way that we define death in Ontario, where neurological criteria is no longer sufficient, and that maybe you have to have or incorporate religious beliefs, because I've heard their lawyer say this several times, but that is the way that it works in New Jersey and in California and in other places, that religious beliefs are incorporated or are taken into consideration.
Do we have any idea either, A, if they will decide to issue a ruling, or B, how the arguments went when they were made and what the future might hold?
We don't know if they are going to issue a decision. I spoke with the family's lawyer on New Year's Eve, and he's hopeful that they will. Arguments, we were in the courtroom for them, and the arguments really surrounded about the constitutionality of the decision and does she still have rights as somebody that is technically or legally deceased? Does she still enjoy the rights afforded to other individuals by the charter? So it's a big issue for the Ontario Court of Appeal to have to weigh in on.
But somebody needs to do it.
Somebody needs to do it. Otherwise, we're going to find ourselves in this situation. It's not going to just be overdose individuals. It's going to be people that you could become brain dead in a variety of ways.
Right.
And if you are devout of whatever your religion or your belief system, you could end up in this situation. They had to come up with this decision. It was actually with the definition of what neurological death is or brain death.
How do they determine that?
There's a variety of factors. It's a long list, and it's like if three or four of these things are in place, but essentially not being able to ever regain consciousness, not seeing brain activity in certain parts. The doctors always argued, and the brain is still very misunderstood, and I understand that, and I'm not a scientist or anything close to having the expertise to weigh in on that, but they were very clear that they thought that a lot of the things that were happening with Takesha were just base reactions.
Right.
And they came up with the definition, and it made it universal across Canada. If you meet three of four or three of five of these boxes, then you were brain dead, and that's that.
Now the question is whether that'll be applied to the charter.
Right.
Thanks, Christina.
Thank you.
Christina Howren, City News reporter. That was The Big Story, brought to you by Scotia iTrade. You can visit scotiaitrade.com to start direct investing today. And for more from us, you can find us at thebigstorypodcast.ca. We've got all of our episodes there. We've got a handy form for you to feed us some tips on what we should be covering next. You can find our sister and brother shows at frequencypodcastnetwork.com. And you can contact us on social media at Big Story Podcast, on Twitter, on Facebook, on Instagram. And all of our shows are everywhere you get podcasts. And we would appreciate a rating, a review, or even just a subscription. I'm Jordan Heath-Rawlings. Thanks for listening. We'll talk tomorrow.